The Protest and the Conference. Chapter 2. Italian War. The emperor immediately reaped the fruits of his new policy. No longer having his hands tied by Germany, he turned them against Rome. The Reformation was to be exalted and the papacy abased. The blows aimed at its pitiless enemy were about to open a new career to the evangelical work. Ferdinand, who was destined by his Hungarian affairs, gave the charge of the Italian expedition to Freundsberg, that old general who had in so friendly a manner patted Luther on the shoulder, as the reformer was about to appear before the Diet of Worms. This veteran, who, as a contemporary observes, bore in his chivalrous heart God's holy gospel, well fortified and flanked by a strong wall, pledged his wife's jewels, sent recruiting parties into all the towns of Upper Germany, and owing to the magic idea of a war against the Pope, soon witnessed crowds of soldiers flocking to his standard. "Announce," Charles had said to his brother, "announce that the army is to march against the Turks. Every one will know what Turks are meant." Thus the puissant Charles, instead of marching with the Pope against the Reformation, as he had threatened at Seville, marches with the Reformation against the Pope. A few days had sufficed to produce this change of direction. There are few periods in history in which the hand of God is more plainly manifested. Charles immediately assumed all the airs of a reformer. On the September 17th, he addressed a manifesto to the Pope, in which he reproaches him for behaving not like the father of the faithful, but like an insolent and haughty man, and declares his astonishment that he, Christ's vicar, should dare shed blood to acquire earthly possessions, which, added he, is quite contrary to the evangelical doctrine. Luther could not have spoken better. "Let your holiness," continued Charles V, "return the sword of St. Peter into the scabbard, and convoke a holy and universal council." But the sword was much more to the pontiff's taste than the council. Is not the papacy, according to the Romish doctors, the source of the two powers? Can it not depose kings, and consequently fight against them? Charles prepared to requite. Eye for eye, and tooth for tooth. Now began that terrible campaign during which the storm burst on Rome and on the papacy that had been destined to fall on Germany and the gospel. By the violence of the blows inflicted on the pontifical city, we may judge of the severity of those that would have dashed in pieces the reformed churches. While retracing such scenes of horror, we have constant need of calling to mind that the chastisement of the seven-hillied city had been predicted by the Holy Scriptures. In the month of November, Freundsberg, at the head of 15,000 men, was at the foot of the Alps. The old general, avoiding the military roads that were well guarded by the enemy, flung himself into a narrow path, over frightful precipices, that a few blows of the mattock would have rendered impassable. The soldiers were forbidden to look behind them. Nevertheless, their heads turned, their feet slipped, and horse and foot rolled from time to time into the abyss. In the most difficult passes, the surest-footed of the infantry lowered their long pikes to the right and left of their aged chief, by way of barrier, and Freundsberg advanced clinging to the lansquenet in front, and pushed on by the one behind. In 3 days the Alps were crossed, and on the November 19th the army reached the territory of Brescia. The constable of Bourbon, who succeeded to the chief command of the imperial army after the death of Pescara, had just taken possession of the Duchy of Milan. The emperor having promised him this conquest for a recompense, Bourbon was compelled to remain there some time to consolidate his power. At length, on the February 12th, he and his Spanish troops joined the army of Freundsberg, which was becoming impatient at his delays. The constable had many men, but no money. He resolved therefore to follow the advice of the Duke of Ferrara, that inveterate enemy of the princes of the church, and proceed straight to Rome. The whole army received this news with a shout of joy. The Spaniards were filled with the desire of avenging Charles V, and the Germans were overflowing with hatred against the Pope. All exulted in the hope of receiving their pay and of having their labors richly repaid at last by those treasures of Christendom that Rome had been accumulating for ages. Their shouts re-echoed beyond the Alps. Every man in Germany thought that the last hour of the papacy had arrived, and prepared to contemplate its fall. "The emperor's forces are triumphing in Italy," wrote Luther. "The Pope is visited from every quarter. His destruction draweth nigh. His hour and his end are come." A few slight advantages gained by the papal soldiers in the Kingdom of Naples led to the conclusion of a truce that was to be ratified by the Pope and by the Emperor. As soon as this was known, a frightful tumult broke out in the constable's army. The Spanish troops revolted, compelled him to flee, and pillaged his tent. Then approaching the lansquenets, they began to shout as loudly as they could, the only German words they knew, Lance, Lance, money, money. Such cries found an echo in the bosoms of the imperialists. They were moved in their turn, and also began to shout with all their might, Lance, Lance, money, money. Freundsberg beat to muster, and having drawn up the soldiers around him and his principal officers, calmly demanded if he had ever deserted them. All was useless. The old affection which the lansquenets bore to their leader seemed extinct. One chord alone vibrated in their hearts. They must have pay in war. Accordingly, lowering their lances, they presented them, as if they would slay their officers, and again began to shout, Lance! Lance! Money! Money! When Freundsberg, whom no army however large had ever frightened, Freundsberg, who was accustomed to say, the more enemies, the greater the honor, saw these lansquenets, at whose head he had grown gray, aiming their murderous steel against him, he lost all power of utterance, and fell senseless upon a drum, as if struck with a thunderbolt. The strength of the veteran general was broken forever. But the sight of their dying captain produced on the lansquenets an effect that no speech could have made. All the lances were upraised, and the agitated soldiers retired with downcast eyes. 4 days later, Freundsberg recovered his speech. Forward, said he to the constable. God himself will bring us to the mark. Forward, forward, repeated the lansquenets. Bourbon had no alternative. Besides, neither Charles nor Clement would listen to any proposals of peace. Freundsberg was carried to Ferrara, and afterwards to his castle of Mindelheim, where he died after an illness of 18 months. And on the April 18th, Bourbon took that high road to Rome, which so many formidable armies coming from the north had already trodden. While the storm descending from the Alps was approaching the Eternal City, the Pope lost his presence of mind, sent away his troops, and kept only his bodyguard. More than 30,000 Romans, capable of bearing arms, paraded their bravery in the streets, dragging their long swords after them, quarreling and fighting. But these citizens, eager in the pursuit of gain, had little thought of defending the Pope, and hoping to derive great profit from his stay, they desired on the contrary that the magnificent Charles would come and settle in Rome. On the evening of the May 5th, Bourbon arrived under the walls of the capital, and he would have begun the assault at that very moment had he been provided with ladders. On the morning of the 6th, the army, concealed by a thick fog which hid their movements, was put in motion, the Spaniards marching to their station above the gate of the Holy Ghost, and the Germans below. The constable, wishing to encourage his soldiers, seized a scaling ladder, mounted the wall, and called on them to follow him. At this moment a ball struck him, he fell, and expired an hour after. Such was the end of this unhappy man, a traitor to his king and to his country, and suspected even by his new friends. His death, far from checking, served only to excite the army. Claudius Seidenstucker, grasping his long sword, first cleared the wall. He was followed by Michael Hartmann, and these two reformed Germans exclaimed that God himself was marching before them in the clouds. The gates were opened, the army poured in, the suburbs were taken, and the Pope, surrounded by 13 cardinals, fled to the castle of St. Angelo. The imperialists, at whose head was now the Prince of Orange, offered him peace on condition of his paying 300,000 crowns. But Clement, who thought that the Holy League was on the point of delivering him, and fancied he already saw their leading horsemen, rejected every proposition. After 4 hours' repose, the attack was renewed, and by sunset the army was master of all the city. It remained under arms and in good order until midnight, the Spaniards in the Piazza Navona, and the Germans in the Campo Fiori. At last, seeing no demonstrations either of war or of peace, the soldiers disbanded and ran to pillage. Then began the famous sack of Rome. The papacy had for centuries put Christendom in the press. Prebends, annates, jubilees, pilgrimages, ecclesiastical graces, she had made money of them all. These greedy troops, that for months had lived in wretchedness, determined to make her disgorge. No one was spared, the imperial not more than the ultramontane party, the Ghibellines not more than the Guelphs. Churches, palaces, convents, private houses, basilics, banks, tombs, everything was pillaged, even to the golden ring that the corpse of Julius II still wore on its finger. The Spaniards displayed the greatest skill, scenting out and discovering treasures in the most mysterious hiding places. but the Neapolitans were the most outrageous. On every side were heard, says Guicciardini, the piteous shrieks of the Roman women and of the nuns whom the soldiers dragged away by companies to satiate their lust. At first the Germans found a certain pleasure in making the Papists feel the weight of their swords. But ere long, happy at procuring victuals and drink, they were more pacific than their allies. It was upon those things which the Romans called holy that the anger of the Lutherans was especially discharged. They took away the chalices, the pyxes, the silver remontrances, and clothed their servants and camp boys with the sacerdotal garments. The Campo Fiore was changed into an immense gambling house. The soldiers brought their golden vessels and bags full of crowns, staked them upon one throw of the dice, and after losing them, went in search of others. A certain Simon Baptista, who had foretold the sack of the city, had been thrown into prison by the Pope. The Germans liberated him, and made him drink with them. But like Jeremiah, he prophesied against all. "Rob, plunder," cried he to his liberators. "You shall, however, give back all. The money of the soldiers and the gold of the priests will follow the same road." Nothing pleased the Germans more than to mock the papal court. "Many prelates," says Guicciardini, "were paraded on asses through all the city of Rome. After this procession, the bishops paid their ransom, but they fell into the hands of the Spaniards, who made them pay it a second time. One day a lansquenet named Guillaume de Saint-Cel put on the Pope's robes and placed the triple crown upon his head. Others gathered round him, adorning themselves with the red hats and long robes of the cardinals, and going in procession upon asses through the streets of the city, they all arrived at last before the castle of Saint Angelo, to which Clement the Seventh had retired. Here the soldier cardinals alighted, and lifting up the front of their robes, kissed the feet of the pretended pontiff. The latter drank to the health of Clement the Seventh. The cardinals kneeling did the same, and exclaimed that henceforward they would be pious popes and good cardinals, careful not to excite wars as their predecessors had done. They then formed a conclave, and the Pope having announced to his consistory that it was his intention to resign the papacy, all hands were immediately raised for the election, and they cried out, "Luther is Pope! Luther is Pope!" Never had pontiff been proclaimed with such perfect unanimity. Such were the humors of the Germans. The Spaniards did not let the Romans off so easily. Clement the Seventh had called them Moors, and had published a plenary indulgence for whoever should kill any of them. Nothing, therefore, could restrain their fury. These faithful Catholics put the prelates to death in the midst of horrible cruelties, destined to extort their treasures from them. They spare neither rank, sex, nor age. It was not until the sack had lasted 10 days, and a booty of 10 millions of golden crowns had been collected, and from 5,000 to 8,000 victims had perished, that quiet began to be in some degree restored. Thus did the pontifical city decline in the midst of a long and cruel pillage, and that splendor with which Rome from the beginning of the 16th century had filled the world faded in a few hours. Nothing could preserve this haughty capital from chastisement, not even the prayers of its enemies. "I would not have Rome burnt," Luther had exclaimed. "It would be a monstrous deed." The fears of Melanchthon were still keener. "I tremble for the libraries," said he. "We know how hateful books are to Mars." But in despite of these wishes of the reformers, the city of Leo X fell under the judgment of God. Clement VII, besieged in the castle of St. Angelo, and fearful that the enemy would blow his asylum into the air with their mines, at last capitulated. He renounced every alliance against Charles V, and bound himself to remain a prisoner until he had paid the army 400,000 ducats. The evangelical Christians gazed with astonishment on this judgment of the Lord. "Such," said they, "is the empire of Jesus Christ, that the emperor, pursuing Luther on behalf of the Pope, is constrained to ruin the Pope instead of Luther. All things minister unto the Lord, and turn against his adversaries."